Hello, thank you again for having me tonight. It's really a pleasure to be here with you. Unfortunately, we're having some technical difficulties, so the slides that I put together I'm not able to project, but luckily I have my laptop with me, so I'm able to look at them to help me move along and keep me on track a little bit. But I do think that rather than sort of follow what I had planned to talk about, I'm just going to kind of take the ball and run, because I think we really heard a really beautiful testimony of the core concepts that I was hoping to share with you this evening in the really wonderful words of the woman who just spoke. The first thing I want to say is, if you've seen me talk before or you've heard my name before, I've been affiliated with a particular organization for quite a number of years. And I now work at an organization that we're pleased to be doing business as Caring Kind, the heart of Alzheimer's caregiving. I want to assure you, if you have been affiliated in any way, shape, or form with the New York City chapter of the Alzheimer's Association, that's who we were before. All of our programs and services are exactly the same as they had been before. This really is a change in name only, and what the change signifies is that we are 100% a local nonprofit organization here in New York City, serving the needs of the dementia community across the five boroughs and beyond. So it's a pleasure. We're excited about our new name and the change. We have a new website. I brought programs and services brochures with me. They're upstairs on the table. You can take a look at what we do, the kinds of services that we provide, all of which are available free of charge to anyone who needs them. Our website address is in that brochure. Our 24-hour helpline number, which is available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year in 200 languages. The number is on the brochure as well. Please take it with you and call. Reach out to us for help. I couldn't agree more with a lot of the things that were shared earlier. First is, if I can't be the president of Leah Horowitz's fan club, I'll be the VP. I'm happy to take that role. I think the work that Zicharon does is tremendous, and we are a proud partner of the organization for many, many years, and we can look forward to continuing to work together in the years to come. Bend like a willow, don't be an oak. I am borrowing that. I'm taking that with me. That sums up what is really key to successfully navigating the road that is caring for somebody with Alzheimer's disease or any other cause of dementia. I think that the concept of taking things as they come and figuring out ways to manage our own expectations and understand that the reality in which we find ourselves now, however much we wish it was different, that this is the reality that we have to figure out how to cope with. And it's not easy, and it's not innate in us, but there are skills that we can learn that make it easier, that allow the road to become a little bit more manageable. We have to be open to that, though. And so being faced with caring for somebody with dementia, whether it's Alzheimer's or any other cause of dementia, and there are many causes of dementia, the key really is in our ability to be flexible. And despite how difficult it is, to figure out a new way to approach and interact with the person for whom we are providing care. We have to give ourselves permission to make mistakes. Some of the concepts that I'm going to talk about tonight may sound obvious when you hear them, but as I said, they're not innate in us. None of us is born with the skills to provide care to somebody with a disease as complex as Alzheimer's disease. However, what we're going to talk about is not 180 degrees different from what we think we should be doing. But it's different enough, and I've talked to enough groups and experience the reactions to what I'm going to share with you, and it's different enough that people often say, I can't believe I've been doing it this way instead of the way that Matt was just talking about it. And what ends up happening is we beat ourselves up. We're very hard on ourselves. I shoulda, I coulda, I woulda. Well, now when we know better, we do better, right? So I'm going to share with you some things that I hope you're able to take with you and employ in your day-to-day interactions with the people for whom you're caring. But even when we talk about it, and even if it sounds on some level like it's relatively easy, and believe me, I know that I stand up here and I can make it sound really easy. I know very well how hard it is. So the first thing I'm going to tell you is that you have to give up the idea of being the perfect caregiver. We have to let go of the idea that we're going to do everything right. We have to let go of the idea that we're going to do everything perfectly. This bar of perfection is impossible to meet. And when we let go of that sort of very high standard that we set for ourselves, and we allow a little bit of room to make mistakes, and to get annoyed, and get frustrated perhaps, lose our patience, not know what to do, that's normal. And this is all about adjusting to the new normal. You're here because you are likely involved in the care of somebody with an illness that results in dementia, right? So you're here because we want to figure out how to change the ways that these situations that we find ourselves in are going right now. So we're going to talk a little bit. What I want to start off with are some definitions so that we're all starting with the same foundation of knowledge. And then I'm going to share with you, layer on top of that foundation of knowledge, some skill building. Some approaches to enhancing our ability to communicate more effectively, some strategies to manage some of the challenging behaviors that often come up, and some strategies for us as caregivers to be better able to take things as they come, to adjust our expectations, and to realize that no matter how much we wish things were different, no matter how much we wish that the old ways of communicating were still true today, it's on us, each of us, to figure out how to embrace and adjust to these new ways. Because the person with the disease, the people for whom we are caring, they can't do any better than they're doing right now. They are in fact doing the best they can. Despite the disease that's resulting in the changes that we're seeing, and despite our strong desire for them to go back to be the way that they were, and our relationships with them to be the way that they were, they're doing the best they can. And when we're able to understand what's happening inside of the brain of the person for whom we're caring, I think we're better able to understand why they're doing what they're doing, why they're saying what they're saying, acting the way they're acting. We're able to remember that the disease is doing this, not the person. And the person at their core remains. The person persists. They're in there. And I've heard people say people with dementia are an empty shell. People with Alzheimer's disease, they're not who they were anymore, and now I'm just caring for this physical being. And I don't believe that at all. I believe wholeheartedly that the person with the disease is in there. They may have lost their ability to communicate with us in the way they used to. They may have become, they may start to behave in ways that are inconsistent with ways they've behaved in the past. But if we have the tools to engage this person in a meaningful way, then we are going to find that essence, that core of that person, and be able to create new opportunities to connect with them in profound and meaningful ways. So I challenge us all to be up for this challenge, and it is, I don't have to tell any of you, a challenge. But we can do it. There are ways. This is not all sadness and loss the end of relationships as we know them. Things are changing, but with the skills and the tools, there are ways that we can make it better. There are ways that we can connect with that person and tap into all of those old ways, so to speak. So we're gonna finish up with some of those strategies that I'm hopeful you're gonna be able to bring back with you and employ. Something else that was said earlier is no 2 days are the same. Again, I echo that sentiment wholeheartedly. If you have met one person with dementia, and I presume each of you knows one person with dementia, you have met one person with dementia. So we'll start at the beginning. What is dementia? What are we talking about when we use this term? Oftentimes, dementia and Alzheimer's are used interchangeably. They're not the same thing. So what is dementia? Dementia in and of itself is actually not a disease. Dementia describes a group of symptoms that affect one's ability to communicate, it affects one's cognition, one's ability to think clearly, it affects personality, and eventually it affects our physical functioning. So we see when somebody is experiencing dementia, they're experiencing a state of mind with, that's affecting their ability to communicate effectively, their ability to think in the way that they always have. It's affecting their behavior, and it's affecting their physical functioning. But each of those categories, memory, thinking, behavior, and physical functioning, each of those categories is very, very broad. And so the nuance within those changes in those areas is going to be unique to the person for whom you are caring. And that means that one-size-fits-all approaches to caring for people with dementia aren't going to work. So we see tremendous value in support groups. We see tremendous value in the family caregiver workshops that we brought to Zicharon, and we will continue to bring to Zicharon moving forward. And sharing with people what's worked for you is very helpful, because people often feel very alone. But just because something works in one situation doesn't mean that it will work in any other situation. And something that works tonight at 8:16 p.m. may not work at 8:45 p.m. It may work again tomorrow morning at 10 in the morning, and then again it won't work at 11. And so it's hard. It's hard for us to make sense of all of these changes. So we know now dementia is not a disease. It's a very generic, a very broad umbrella term, if you will, that talks about a state of mind where one is experiencing changes in those four areas, in memory, in thinking, in behavior, and physical functioning. There are roughly 100 different causes of that state of mind that is dementia. Alzheimer's disease is one cause. Alzheimer's disease is, in fact, a disease. There's a pathology with Alzheimer's. It's not talking about the symptoms, it's talking about what's causing the symptoms. Does that make sense? Okay. Alzheimer's is a progressive degenerative disease that's resulting in the death of neurons or nerve cells, which we all have in our brains, that enable us to function independently on a daily basis. So we all have about 100 billion neurons inside of our brains. Our neurons are transmitting messages. So you heard the term synapses firing. That's the way in which our brain communicates, the cells in our brain communicate with each other that enable us to function. So the way that I'm formulating my sentences right now and looking around the room while I'm speaking with you, the way that I often annoyingly talk with my hands, the way that if I wanted to go over there and shut that door, I don't think right foot, left foot, right foot, left foot. My brain is sending the messages to let my body know that I'm going to move in this way. All these things we take for granted. None of us is sitting here thinking, inhale, exhale, inhale. Right? Our body is taking care of those functions, and it's because our neurons are doing the job that they're supposed to do. People who have Alzheimer's disease, the pathology of the illness is getting in the way of those neurons doing what we so often take for granted. So the messages that we take for granted aren't getting transmitted in the way we need them to for our to allow us to function in the way that we once did. Does that make sense? Okay. So dementia, a very broad generic umbrella term that is not in and of itself an illness. Underneath that umbrella, we have Alzheimer's disease and about 99 other causes of dementia. So a way to think about the distinction, the difference between dementia and Alzheimer's, is dementia is to Alzheimer's disease as soda is to Coke. So that soda is a very broad generic category under which you'll find Coke, Pepsi, 7-Up, Sprite, ginger ale, root beer, etc., right? So if somebody says, I'd like a soda, you don't really know what they want. So you say, well, what kind of soda? And then they can clarify for you. Very similarly, if someone says, a doctor even, this person is experiencing dementia, we don't really know what's going on. We know they're going to have changes in memory, thinking, behavior, and physical functioning, but we don't know why. We don't know what's causing them. So when we're talking about Alzheimer's disease, we're talking about a disease that has a pretty predictable onset and a pretty predictable progression. Alzheimer's disease starts in a part of the brain that's called the hippocampus. And I'm going to back up one step and say that our brains are incredibly complex. Our brains are compartmentalized. So that very specific region, and I know this science stuff can be overwhelming and eyes start to gloss over, and I'm a social worker by training, so we're going to talk about all of this in a way that you're going to understand. And again, the purpose is not for you to pass some test later. It's for you to be able to put yourselves in the shoes of the person for whom you're caring and translate that into patience and empathy and understanding so that we're set up better for success, right? So all the pieces of this are going to fit together nicely, I promise. So our brains are compartmentalized, so that very specific regions of our brain are responsible for very specific functions or ability. So the disease, Alzheimer's disease, always starts in the same part of the brain. It starts in a part of the brain called the hippocampus. And the primary function of the hippocampus is to aid in the creation of new memories. The hippocampus is where our short-term memories live. So if Alzheimer's disease always starts in the part of the brain where our short-term memories live, that's why short-term memory loss is usually the earliest indication that someone may be experiencing Alzheimer's disease. Now, there are other things that cause that similar early symptoms, and I think that's where some of the confusion lies. We see memory loss and we jump to Alzheimer's disease, and that's not necessarily always the case. Roughly 70% of all dementia, so roughly 70% of that broader dementia is Alzheimer's disease, which is why I think those terms are so often used interchangeably. But now we know they're not the same thing. If someone has Alzheimer's disease, they are experiencing that state of mind of dementia. But if someone is experiencing dementia, it may or may not be Alzheimer's disease. It could be vascular dementia, which is the result of strokes, where a very particular part of the brain is robbed of oxygen that's necessary for that part of the brain to function properly. It may be Lewy body dementia, which looks similar to Parkinson's disease, but they're different. They're sort of cousins, if you will. So you're going to see some of the memory changes as Alzheimer's disease, but you're also going to see some Parkinsonian symptoms like physical rigidity or REM sleep disturbance, some problems with muscles and gait, the ability to walk effectively, tremors, things of that nature. The cause of the symptoms that you're seeing may be something called frontotemporal dementia, which affects the frontal lobes of the brain and the temporal lobes, which are on the side, which is not where the hippocampus lives, which means you may not be seeing memory changes, but maybe you're seeing changes in language, which affects our ability to communicate, or behavioral changes, people acting in ways that they've never acted before, but their memory is intact, so we're not thinking it's dementia. And I'm sharing all of this with you, not to complicate matters, but to help you understand that these are very, very complex diseases to diagnose, and that we're not doing anyone any good by assuming we understand why they're acting the way they're acting. We can't say, well, I've seen it before, or I read a book, or I talked to someone who knows, or I looked online, or I went to a doctor even, because often people jump to assumptions. And we need to do our due diligence and make sure that the doctor who's diagnosing the person for whom we are caring is looking beyond just Alzheimer's disease, because this is what we tend to jump to as an assumption. Does that make sense? Okay. The reason why it's important that we know is so that we can lend some real information to what's going on. The reason why we want to make sure that we let the person understand what's happening to him or to her is so that they have a context of what's going on with them. Because in the early stage of the disease, people know that things are changing. They know they have moments of clarity, and they know that they have moments of confusion. They may not be able to accept it. They may not be willing to admit it or talk about it. But in the early stage of the disease, when only a limited part of the brain is affected, the person absolutely knows that something's going on. By the time we get to the middle stage of the disease, this looks very, very different. All the symptoms that we saw in the early stage of the disease are now exacerbated. And now we're seeing new symptoms, and people are relying on others for more assistance and support. In the middle stage of the disease, people are less able to understand the implications of their illness. In the late stage of the disease, even more of the areas of the brain are now affected by the illness. and people are relying on others for all aspects of care. So when we talk about Alzheimer's disease, we're talking about a progressive, degenerative disease of the brain that results in the death of these neurons or nerve cells that we rely on to function independently every day, right? The disease starts in one very specific area of the brain, and from there it moves to all the other areas of the brain. And as the disease moves to all these other areas of the brain, that's when we're starting to see the symptoms begin to persist and develop further. So the speed with which the disease moves through the brain and the path that it takes, which part of the brain it goes to next, is what gives us the stages of the illness. So depending upon how far along someone is through the progression of the disease, we're able to gauge based on their behavior, what they can do, what they can't do, how they're spending their time, how independently they're functioning. Early on in the disease, when we talk about early stage dementia, early stage Alzheimer's, we're talking about very high functioning people. We're talking about people who may live alone and may be safe living alone. We're talking about people who may need minor assistance with meal preparation or food shopping or getting to doctor's appointments or someone pre-pouring their medication for them, reminding them to take their medication, things like that. Notes, post-its, calendars can be very helpful in the early stage of the disease. People in the early stage of the disease, we want to honor their independence. At the heart of early stage is independence. We want people doing as much as they can for themselves as possible. We want to encourage people to do as much as they can as possible. And we need to be mindful. If people in the early stage know that they're having moments of confusion and moments of clarity, we need to be mindful. If we put ourselves in their shoes, we must be mindful of the tremendous impact on their autonomy, their self-esteem, their sense of dignity, their sense of self-respect, these changes are bringing about. So we cannot come in and take away the keys and tell them they can't live alone anymore and not allow them to do things by themselves and I'll go with you here and you can't and I have to and you'd better, because we want to make sure that they're still doing as much as they can for themselves, by themselves. Recognizing that we don't know when they're going to need more support, right? So again, it's not a one-size-fits-all. It would be very easy, or much easier, if the transition from early stage to middle stage was very clear-cut. And I could say to you, well, the person you're caring for is in the early stage now, but a week from tomorrow, he'll be in the middle stage. And so let's make sure in the next 7 days we get everything we need in order. Unfortunately, it doesn't work like that. The disease is insidious by nature. You don't lose one neuron and all of a sudden not know what's happening around you or where you're supposed to be or what's going to happen next. So by the time you're seeing changes in someone, even early stage symptoms that just get you thinking something's going on, we should go to the doctor. This is different, right? The disease has been developing in the brain for 10 or 12 years. So the damage to the neurons, the loss to that 100 billion neurons that we all have inside our brains, is so profound that now it's starting to show itself. That makes sense? So this is a new reality both for the person and a new reality for everybody involved in their care. This is when that willow, bending like that willow, really starts to be incredibly important. We need to modify our expectations. We need to figure out how to accept our new reality. And that's what this is. And that struggle between reconciling the complicated feelings of seeing someone we care for declining as a result of this illness with wanting everything to be the way that it was is so complicated. And you cannot do it alone. You may think you can. You may feel like you should. You may want to, for lots of reasons. There's fear, there's shame, there's guilt, there's anger, there's frustration, then more fear, then more guilt, then more frustration, then more anger, then more fear, then more guilt, then more anger, then right? You cannot do it alone. And when I say that, my hope is what you're hearing is permission to ask for and accept help. None of us like to do that. We talk about what's going on a little bit, maybe, to close friends, close family, people who are close to us. And we say, I'm okay, I'm okay. What can I do to help? We're all right. I'll let you know. We're not strong enough to do this alone. And I think the fact that there are this many of you here tonight really hungry for this information shows that we can't do it alone. And I think, you know, again, the point that was made earlier, this disease is incredibly isolating. It's isolating for the person living with it. So in the early stage of the disease, we've talked a little bit about what some of those symptoms look like. People start to withdraw from things that have historically brought them pleasure or engagement. Some of that is because their home is often a place that they're very familiar with and where they feel incredibly safe. And outside is a little bit more unnerving as they become more confused about what's going on around them. So they'll start to withdraw, or they're finding themselves not able to maintain the thread of the conversation, or they're getting embarrassed or uncomfortable because they're forgetting what's going on or what's happening or where they're going or who's with them or what they were talking about or someone's name or recent events because of that short-term memory loss. And because they're aware of what's happening, they sort of create this cocoon for themselves of safety by withdrawing from activities that they've historically participated in. As the disease progresses, it becomes incredibly isolating for the caregiver too, because they're requiring more and more support from you, so you're forced to withdraw from things that you've historically found enjoyable. And because we're dedicated to the people for whom we're providing care, and there's somebody who needs you now. And so you're putting yourself, your own needs aside, and you're struggling, because it is a struggle. You'll never hear anything coming out of my mouth about this becoming easy, being easy or becoming easy. I hope that I can give you some strategies that make it easier, some tools that make it somewhat more manageable, some concepts and approaches to be new ways of thinking about this that help for you to sort of reconcile how complicated it is. But it's not going to be easy. So as it becomes isolating for the individual with the disease, it becomes just as isolating for you. And it's very easy to feel alone, like you're the only one going through it, like nobody can possibly understand how hard it is. And on some level, that's absolutely true. Because I said before, if you've met one person with dementia, you've met one person. So each of the journeys that you're all on is unique and different to your experience, because all of our brains are unique. So diseases that affect our brains are unique. Does that make sense? So the path that you're taking and the path the person you're caring for is on is going to look very different than the path of the person sitting close to you. But I'm here to tell you that you're not alone. And I don't have to tell you that. Look around the room. And this is a fraction of the people who are affected by the disease. But I'm so glad that you've taken time out of your evenings to come so that we can really recognize the impact that the disease is having on us. So at the heart of early stage, again, independence, honoring the independence of the person, allowing that person to do as much as he or she can as possible. By the time the disease moves to the middle stage, and the person enters the middle stage of the disease, it really is no longer safe for the person to be living alone. And as I mentioned, the disease is insidious. And so it's not the kind of thing where we can say, well, you're safe on your own now, but you know, in 10 days, everything's going to look different. People often have a strong foothold in the early stage, and they begin dipping a toe or two in the middle stage. And because of the insidious nature of the illness, that sort of the way that it changes, every moment can sort of be different. The person will transition relatively slowly into the middle stage. When the person is in the middle stage, he or she is really not safe living alone anymore. And so that means that we have to continue to be comfortable asking for and accepting help. It means that perhaps the living arrangements need to change. It doesn't necessarily mean that the person needs to live with you. And by that I mean we are allowed to have boundaries that protect our own well-being. We need to take just as good care of ourselves as we are taking of the person with the disease. Sometimes the impact of having someone move in with us or us moving in with someone else has a tremendously negative impact on our own well-being, on our family, on our young children perhaps. There are safety concerns about the interactions of the person with the disease and someone younger. The person with the illness is no longer able to use reason and logic in the same way that we all can use reason and logic, which makes communicating really difficult even early on. And that's sort of with the therapeutic lying, or the fiblets as we call them, come into play. If you lie to someone, which I understand is not a part of who we are, when you lie to someone, there's an intent there. When we restructure our message to somebody with dementia, that negative intent that we associate with lying isn't there. Sometimes the ends justify the means. We are not lying as much as we are reframing the message in a way that the person with the disease can understand. Because if we go with the way that we all can communicate with each other, which is you haven't taken a shower in a while, and we need to get you clean, that's not going to work with somebody who no longer has the ability to process reason and logic the way they once could. So we have to figure out a way, creatively, for the end to justify the means. How do we get the person to take a bath if they aren't willing to, and us saying, you are dirty, we need you to get clean, is it working? Or I'm not dirty, I just took a bath. How do you reason with that? How do you get around that in a way that isn't reframing a message? We need to be creative, and I'll talk strategies and examples to give examples to how I think some of, and there are lots of ways, right? It's all about sort of what's going to work in your situation, because again, there's no one size fits all. So what I'm trying to give you now are strategies, ways to conceptualize our approach. Not, oh, just do this, just say that, and it'll work. You're going to have to figure out, based on who you're caring for, how to take this concept and apply it to your situation. So we're talking about broad approaches. Again, it's tools in your toolboxes, if you will. So early stage is independence. Middle stage is safety. By the time the person's in the middle stage of the disease, he or she is really unsafe alone. But again, that doesn't necessarily mean that you need to augment your living situation to accommodate this person. Someone has to have more of a close eye on the individual. But that can be met with home care. That can be met with assisted living facilities. In some cases, nursing homes can be a really viable option. And that, there's a lot, those are really charged words. Nursing homes have a lot of grab for people. Like they're sort of hot places. That's not the phrase I mean to use. But I think sometimes we have to recognize our own limitations. And there's a theory of for everything you do for somebody with dementia, you need to do something for yourself. If we give and give and give and give and never do anything to refuel our tanks, to recharge our batteries, so to speak, we will soon have nothing left to give. And then what good are we to the person who's relying on us? If we don't take care of ourselves and our own needs in a really meaningful way, how can we possibly continue to provide the kind of care that somebody with this disease is going to need? I'm here to tell you that we can't. The disease takes a toll in every single way imaginable. Physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, psychologically, financially, we cannot do it alone in any of those ways. So figuring out how to make sure that the person is getting the attention he or she needs in a way that maintains him or herself safely in the community is essential. And recognizing that we may need to rely on others to provide some of that support and that care is really key as well. In the late stage of the disease, I'm gonna take questions at the end, I promise. In the late stage of the disease, when the person becomes even more reliant on us, they're relying on others for all aspects of their care, the key really is comfort. How can we make sure that the person is as comfortable as possible when they're really not able to communicate with us in any sort of meaningful way any longer? And that's all about knowing the person. So honoring independence, ensuring safety, and maintaining comfort. And I challenge you not only to respond to discomfort, so that when someone gives you some sort of indication that they are uncomfortable, that we do something to make them comfortable. I challenge you to think about never allowing them to become uncomfortable. And that means we're anticipating needs, that we're doing the best that we can to bring about a sense of comfort so that discomfort never has the opportunity to present itself. And throughout all of this is really the understanding of the key and core principles of dementia care, which is person-centered. So all the things that I'm sort of touching on very broadly require you to know very well the individual for whom you are caring. I talk about tools in your toolboxes, knowing this person's preferences in every way, the foods they like, the foods they don't like, the music they enjoy, the music they don't enjoy, what time they like to wake up, what time they go to sleep, if they shower in the morning, if they prefer to take baths at night, what's important to this person spiritually, the role that family plays, if they like children, if they don't necessarily like children, if they like, you know, pets, if they don't like pets, all the things, knowing what scares them, knowing what makes them comfortable, knowing that their hot buttons or their triggers, things that make them anxious or upset. We know the people we're caring for, right? We know them well. Oh, I don't want to have to tell this person this because they're going to get upset about it. We know the triggers, right? We know that someone doesn't like being rushed to get ready and leave the house. So we accommodate them by leaving more time. The more we know about the individual, the more set up we are for success. Does that make sense as a concept? So if we start to think about who this person is and who this person has historically been, what kinds of things bring about a sense of calm? What kinds of things bring about a sense of comfort? Now we understand how to set ourselves and this person up for success. So let's say the person likes chocolate. I'm never going anywhere near that person without chocolate in my pocket. Because I know as soon as I start to see the person starts to become agitated, I'm going to say, ooh, look what I found. This is a concept we call making the brain a better offer. People get stuck on something with Alzheimer's disease and other causes of dementia. And we try to get in there and help them make sense of it in a way that calms them down. In a way that if you got upset, I might be able to calm you down by telling you it's okay, by using reason and logic. Well, I'm upset, we don't have a projector, and Matt's going to come with his slides, and we're not going to... And I say, it's all right, because I bet he really knows what he's talking about, and he's going to be able to wing it, and everything's going to be fine. That's reason and logic, and that would work with me, and maybe with Leah. But it may not work with somebody with dementia, because they no longer have the ability to process information in that way. So it's up to us to figure out new ways to rationalize and reason. When the old ways don't work, we have to make a change. You've heard of that expression, it takes two to tango? It takes two to tangle. So if interactions that you're having with somebody with dementia are going like this, raise your hand if you've ever argued with someone with Alzheimer's or dementia. And let's be really honest. Who's argued? Keep your hand up if you've won that argument. When we argue with someone, we're going back to the old ways of communicating because we've been able to argue with the person before, right? We need new ways. Arguing requires a level of reason and logic and understanding of the context that we are all living in. It requires our believing the facts and the reality of the situation in which we find ourselves. People with Alzheimer's disease and other causes of dementia throughout the spectrum of the illness no longer have that ability to join us in that world. So the first concept is really making the brain a better offer. and understanding the tools that are required of you in order to do so. A second concept is what we call the theory of the two worlds. There's the world in which we live, which is rooted in reason and logic and facts and reality. And then there's the world in which the person with dementia is living, which is not rooted in any of those things. The person with dementia's world is rooted in the reality in which he or she is finding himself right now in this very moment. I mentioned to you earlier that the disease, that Alzheimer's disease, not every cause of dementia, but the most common cause of dementia, starts in the part of the brain where our short-term memory is located. So that short-term memory loss is often an early indication that someone may be experiencing Alzheimer's. Now we know that it may not be Alzheimer's, but it's worth going to the doctor, going to the neurologist, and finding out. But your long-term memories don't live in the hippocampus. I mentioned earlier that the brain is compartmentalized. Your long-term memories live in a different part of the brain, a part of the brain in the back of the brain called the cerebellum, which I think about like a filing cabinet. It's where we file all of our long-term memories. So if in 30 or 40 years you remember something that I said, I remember that Matt said, make the brain a better offer, or the disease starts in the hippocampus, whatever it is. If you remember something in 40 years that I said tonight, a chemical process occurred in your brain that literally moved that memory from your hippocampus, where your short-term memory lives, to your cerebellum, where your long-term memory lives. If the disease starts in the hippocampus and then moves to all the other areas of the brain, it takes a long time before it gets to the back of the brain where your long-term memories live. So if you've ever experienced the person you're caring for not knowing what happened 5 minutes ago, but being able to tell you with such specificity something that happened 50 years ago or 60 years ago, and you're sitting there thinking, how is this possibly happening right now? That's why. Has it ever happened to any of you? With someone, we just finished eating, and the person says, well, when's lunch? I'm starving. You think, you have food on your shirt. Your plate is in front of you. And then 2 minutes later, they're telling you, you know, about the interior of the Pontiac Bonneville that they got when they were 18 and got their license. You think, this doesn't make sense. We're trying to use reason and logic to understand what is happening here. Their reality, their world in which the person with dementia is living right now, is rooted in wherever they find themselves right now today. So as their short-term memories erode, they're no longer living in this present moment, in a sense. If they see themselves as living in those older memories, their reality is that time. Their reality is that place. Their reality is how old they were then. And too often what we do, our sort of innate knee-jerk response to that, is to try and shake the dementia out of them, so to speak. What's called reality orientation. So you're not 25. We're not in your 1958 Pontiac Bonneville. It's March. It's 2016. It's New York. Right? We want to get them back to today, to reality. Who do you think that's for? Really? If we really ask ourselves that question honestly, it's for us. Because it doesn't matter to that person. And they may not remember it in 5 minutes. Or they may feel badly because they say, oh yeah. And now what's happening? What's going on? So this theory of the two worlds is us dragging the person with the disease into our world. And that's when this conflict comes up. That's when the arguing is. No, I'm not your wife or your husband, or your friend, or your mom, or your dad. I'm your son, or your daughter, or your husband, right? We try to, no. It's not this, it's that. And we're trying to help. And it makes sense that that's what we're trying to do. Because we think, if I can get you to understand where we are and what's going on, then okay, we're back, so to speak, right? Rather than drag the person with the disease into our world, where this happens, we need to figure out how to step into the world that the person is living in. And that's about yes and, as opposed to no. No. No shuts it all down. No ends the interaction. So if we're getting changes in relationships because the person's living in that different time, right? Or we're getting, I want to do this. And our response is no. We shut down those opportunities for relationship and interaction in a way that is really counterproductive. As the caveat to stepping into the world of the person with the disease, the caveat is safety. So if somebody says, well, I want to go and run out there, with my bathrobe on into the street, we don't say, well, Matt said, go along with it, step into the world of the person, and we do that, right? So safety is really where the line in the sand is drawn. But if there's no harm in the person thinking that it's November and we're in Florida, step into the world of the person. I love Florida in November because it's so cold up north. What's your favorite part about being in Florida in November? Right? And that's just one example. I'm going along for the ride because there's no harm in that. And not only is there no harm, there's opportunity. There's opportunities for me to explore with you your reality, and there are opportunities for us to have really interesting interactions and meaningful and profound communications. If someone's asking for their mom, we hear that a lot, I want my mom. And maybe their mother passed away 10, 15, 20 years ago. In some cases, our knee-jerk response is to tell the person that their mother died. And don't you remember you were there at the funeral, and she died of this, and it was here, and you spoke. Right? Again, we're trying to help orient them to that reality. It's often as if they're hearing this news for the first time. And so we see these very emotional reactions, because the reality of that person is not March of 2016. They're living in that different time. So we don't do that for fear of re-traumatizing the person. And we don't do that because that's the no response. But when someone asks for mom, what might they be needing on an emotional level? When we want our mother. Say again?
Comfort.
Love. Affection? Love? Absolutely. So what's underneath the communication? What's the need that the person is expressing to us? It's not about mom. Maybe it's about anxiety. Maybe it's about fear. Maybe it's about not being rooted in reality today and looking around and not knowing who's here, where I am, why I'm here, what I'm supposed to be doing, what's happening next, knowing it's not right, it doesn't feel right, so it brings up all of that angst, that anxiety, that fear, that desire to go, this isn't right, I'm not supposed to be here, I'm out of here, and we go. If we're able to address the need, and we step into the world of the person, says, I want my mom, and we say, well, mom isn't here right now, but tell me about mom. You miss your mom. You love your mom. What's your favorite memory about mom? All these different, and I don't mean literally say exactly what I'm saying. Again, I'm trying to give you a framework, a shift in your perspective, so that we start to respond in slightly different ways that open up opportunities for us to address the needs of the person, as opposed to just what the person is saying. So if we see anxiety or fear or agitation or despair, how can we validate those feelings, empathize with what the person is experiencing, and explore with them positive aspects of the underlying situation? So we don't want to, in those situations, we're not going to lie and say, well, mom will be back later. Because wouldn't you know, the one thing that person's short-term memory holds on to is, mom's going to be back later, mom's going to be back later. Where's mom? You said mom will be back later. Right? And that's that sort of, that's not even therapeutic lying, that's just sort of lying. And it doesn't address the need. Mom coming back later will sort of lead me to perseverate on that anxiety and that fear and that longing and that wanting, right? Does that make sense? But if we're able to explore the need that's underneath the sort of behavior or the communication, if you will, then we're able to address it. Behavior is the same way. We often label people as what they do. So she screams, he bites, she kicks, he yells, she throws things, watch out. She's aggressive, he's violent. Does that resonate with any of the experiences you have? Some of these behavioral changes that we tend to see? We're missing opportunities when we label people as what they're doing. We have to be detectives, in a sense, and explore not just what they're doing. It's not enough to stop at the behavior. We have to figure out why they're doing what they're doing. We have to rethink what behavior is. My challenge to you is to begin to think about behavior as communication. When people no longer have the ability to communicate in words or in ways that we have historically communicated with one another, the way I might tell you, I'm hungry, or these lights are really bright, or it's cold in here, or there are shadows on the walls that are scaring me a little bit, or I have to go to the bathroom, or my shoe is tied too tight, or my belt is pinching my stomach, or I don't feel well, or I have a headache, or the TV is too loud, or the room is too loud and there's an echo when I'm talking and I can't. If we don't have the ability to communicate those things in the same way we always have, we tell people through our behavior. So if you give me a task, like a puzzle, because I've always liked puzzles. So I'm gonna go back to activities in a minute. If you want to engage me in something that's historically brought me pleasure, and I've loved jigsaw puzzles my whole life, and you're afraid that a 3,000 piece puzzle is, I'm not going to be able to do it. So you give me one of those kids puzzles that's a map of the United States that's like 6 pieces, and like all, you know, a lot of states are attached. You know the puzzles that I'm referring to? And you think, well, here's a puzzle that you can do. And I look at you like, you got to be kidding me, because I feel I know what that's for. That's for a baby. That's for a kid. And I take that puzzle and I throw it across the room. Don't stop it. I'm aggressive or I'm violent. What am I telling you? I could be telling you a lot of things. I could be telling you that you're treating me like a child. I could be telling you that I don't want to do this dumb puzzle right now. I could be telling you that something else is going on, that I'm hungry or that I'm in pain. It could be all these other things. So it's not enough to stop at Matt threw that thing that I just gave him across the wall, so I don't know what to do with that. We need to explore what the unmet need is. Does that make sense? Does that sound doable? No? It doesn't? It seems so far from where you are, is that what you're saying? The person doesn't understand that? Is that what you said? So the person with the disease doesn't understand? I'm not talking to the person with the disease. I'm talking to you. So if the person with the disease is behaving in ways that are inconsistent with his or her past, the person with the disease is doing the best he or she can. So the challenge is for us to figure out what he or she needs. What is the person with the disease telling us in the way he or she is behaving that can allow us to address that unmet need? Does that make sense? Well, at least what I'm saying as a concept? Yeah, it's not easy. The last time I came out here, someone said, my father thinks every night is Shabbos. Oh, now I'm getting heads nodding. Every night wants to light the candles. And I said, light the candles. Why can't we light the candles? Why can't we step into the world? So what do we say? It's not Shabbos. It's Wednesday. It's not Shabbos, it's Tuesday. It's not Shabbos, it's Monday. There's six other days that it's not going to be Shabbos, right? So all we're doing is dragging the person into our world. But if we could say that lighting these candles does no harm, and it's not arguing with the person, it's stepping into the world of the person, honoring the dignity of that person, why can't we do that? It's tough for us because it's not Shabbos. But this is where the bending like a willow comes in. If you're stuck to the old ways, if it has to be the way that it's always been, I can't help you. It cannot be the way that it's always been. Thank you. Are we stuck wanting it to be the way it's always been? Yeah? All right, so let's spend a minute on that. We talk at work with our professional staff at Caring Kind about how people call us asking for concrete solutions. They want answers to their very specific questions. How do I get the person to do this? How do I get the person to stop doing that? Tell me what to do when. Very concrete, specific things. And our social workers are trained to understand that you cannot have the concrete without dealing with the emotional. You can never, ever remove the emotional impact of seeing someone you care about succumbing to a disease like Alzheimer's disease. So the first step, really, I guess, the first step toward embracing the changes and the approaches that I'm talking about with you today is coming to terms with what this disease means. We're talking about a progressive degenerative disease for which there is no cure, for which there is no way to slow it down, for which there is no way to stop it. That's terrible news for me to share with you. I'm the bearer of the worst news. It is the unfortunate reality of the situation that each of us is finding ourselves in. No matter how much we want to find a way to slow it down, to stop it, to prevent it, the facts of the matter are that those ways, those solutions do not yet exist. No matter how much we want the solution, the one thing that's going to make it go away, the one way that's going to make it better, the one strategy that's going to wave a magic wand and bring the person back to who he was and who she was in our relationship before, I am sorry to tell you that it doesn't yet exist. So in lieu of that solution, in lieu of that magic wand, if you will, the best treatment is the highest quality of person-centered care. And that's where the strategies that I'm talking about really come into play. We have to accept our new reality. We don't have to like it. But if we refuse to bend, if we only will live in our past reality, then nothing can change in the way we're interacting with the person. So I know that you're not going to leave here and say, oh, well, I've just embraced this new reality that I find myself in. I recognize that. And that's where asking for and receiving help is the necessary first step. Because until we can figure out how, on some level, not necessarily fully, but on some level realize that there is a disease that is causing the changes that we are seeing in this person, none of the other things that I shared with you today are going to make a difference. And if we can't, then we have to figure out how. Because how's it going now? If it's working all that well, if you've got this down, you're probably not sitting in this room. Right? I mean, really. And I can say with great confidence that it's probably not going that well because this is super hard. This is really difficult. And I started, remember, I started by saying, I make it sound like it's easy. I talk about, oh, step into the world of the person, stop arguing, stop doing quizzing and testing and reality-oriented. As conscious, when I talk about it, it sounds like I think this is a breeze. I know firsthand this is not a breeze. I'm planting seeds in you, at least I'm hoping to. Plant seeds to bring about a shift in your perspective, to be open to the idea that we have to accept the new reality of the situation if we want the interactions to be any different than they are right now. The person with the disease is doing the best he can, the best she can. They cannot change. They're not doing it on purpose. They're not doing us to drive us crazy. They're not doing us to manipulate us. They're not doing it to because she was always like this and he was always like that. No. They're doing the absolute best they can. And if we want it to be different, it's on us to change. We must change. So maybe I didn't start in the right spot. Maybe I should have started with, we have to figure out a way to reconcile how complicated this is if we want it to be different. And that requires reaching out for help. You're not going to be able to do that on your own. Believe me, you can't. You can't. And that's why there are great organizations like Zicharon. That's why there are great organizations like Caring Kind, where we can help you. And we start where you are. So we don't start at, well, here's where you have to be. We start at what's going on right now. Tell us the issues that you're dealing with. Tell us about the person. Tell us about your relationship to the person. So we can develop a unique strategy and approach to support you emotionally and help you reconcile the complicated piece of this emotionally, because you can't ever remove the emotional piece of seeing this person and dealing with this individual as they decline. But once we start, not fully, but start to accept our new reality, once we open up to the idea that things can be different and that we understand that it's on us to be the driver of that change, well, now we're open to employing the strategies that I've been talking about in a new way. Does that resonate a little more? Sort of? Okay, so did you have another, you were very patient, so before I answer a question in the back, did you have another question that I can try and answer? Is there scientific research that shows that calcium deposits in the brain may have something to do with Alzheimer's disease? So the cause of Alzheimer's disease as yet is really not known. We do know a lot, and we know a lot more than we ever did, and there is a tremendous amount of research going on every minute of every day in trying to figure this out. But there's a lot more that we don't know than what we do know. I would argue, so that's sort of the best answer that I can give you for that. About calcium deposits specifically, to my knowledge, there's not a link to that. But I'm not a doctor, I'm not a research scientist at all. I read about it all the time. There's so much out there. And you know what my response to that question really would be? We need to learn how to be better consumers of this kind of information. So with a disease that's progressive and degenerative, that has no preventive measure, no way to slow it down, no way to stop it, it feels really hopeless. And unfortunately, there are people out there who are preying on our hopes and our fears, and who are sharing information that's not necessarily rooted in the science. We need to be good consumers of scientific information, good consumers of research. We need to be really discerning in what we read and in what we believe. There's a lot out there. There's a lot out there about lifestyle changes. There's a lot out there about drink coffee, don't drink coffee, drink red wine. Not too much red wine, eat dark chocolate. It has to be this percentage of cocoa, not that percentage of cocoa. Blueberries. There's aluminum and deodorant. Don't use deodorant. Don't use aluminum pans. That, I'm happy to tell you, has been debunked. So use deodorant. Use aluminum pans. There's no link. Right. Lead. Lead paint. All these things have not been researched enough for us to have a real understanding of the impact. And I think one of the problems with the fact that we live in this 24-hour news environment is that new has become news. New does not equal news. New equals new. And I think one of the other issues is that a lot of the things that we read about in the Times, you know, respected media outlets, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, in my opinion, some of this stuff is more appropriate for a peer-reviewed journal that most of us in the room aren't looking at. Because there's not enough research that they're reporting on that can be applied to the population at large. So if you read about a new study that says it does X, Y, and Z, we don't always do our due diligence and look at, well, how many people were in that study? When we look at an outcome of a study that says it was discovered in mice that this intervention clears the plaques that are related to Alzheimer's disease, and this is a breakthrough in Alzheimer's research, well, there's a long way to go between mice and human beings. And obviously, if they're reporting on the mice, it's because they haven't tested it yet on the human beings. We read a lot about phase one drug trial results. Well, the way that drug trials go is that phase one is solely about safety. It's just to make sure that there are no negative health outcomes from this pill. They're not looking at the outcomes of, in terms of impact of that pill in phase one. They're only looking at safety. So if you hear or you read phase one looks hopeful for outcome for Alzheimer's, phase one is an incredibly small group of people because there are safety concerns. So good outcomes in phase one, as far as the impact of the medication, we need to know that that doesn't tell us anything usable yet. So we have to become better at understanding what it is we're reading, understanding what it is we are trying. There's a lot about, you know, coconut oil. You go on the internet and you see a person who was given X amount of coconut oil every day and did that clock test, and wow, look what happened. If coconut oil was the cure to Alzheimer's disease, we would know about that. I would be eating coconut oil every day. I mean, and I'm not saying that maybe there isn't something in there that has some I'm not discounting all that. What I'm saying is we don't know yet. There has not been enough research, and people are preying on our hope and our fear that we're going to buy into whatever it is that they're selling. And we I get that hope. You know, when I talk about a disease that feels hopeless, any ounce of hope we grab onto with both hands often. So we need to be better at understanding what it is that we're reading and being told. What I can tell you, because a lot of times people are worried about genetics and they're worried about risk, what I can tell you is that there are two types of genetic Alzheimer's. Is this what you want to know? You want this? Some of you, yes, some of you know, so I'll do it quickly. There are two types of Alzheimer's as it relates to genes. There's deterministic Alzheimer's disease, which means you have a genetic mutation in a gene that means you will absolutely develop Alzheimer's. Genetic Alzheimer's is exceedingly rare, incredibly rare, like less than 3% of all cases. Very, very rare. Genetic Alzheimer's disease, where it's deterministic, which means you will unequivocally, no matter what, develop Alzheimer's, affects generations of families, and usually at much younger ages than what we typically see. You would likely know if your family had genetic Alzheimer's disease. The other kind of Alzheimer's disease that's affected by genes is not deterministic. It's about risk. So you inherit a copy of a gene from your mom and a copy of that same gene from your dad. If you go back to biology in school, we know that there are dominant genes and recessive genes. There are genes that are linked to a higher risk of Alzheimer's. If you inherit one copy of a higher risk gene from your mom and a copy of a no risk gene from your dad, you're at a greater risk of developing the disease than the general population, but you might not develop it. If you inherit a high-risk gene from your mom and a high-risk gene from your dad, you're at an even greater risk of developing the disease, but you still might not develop it. So there are genes that speak to deterministic Alzheimer's, and there are genes that speak to risk. The best thing that we can do to modify our risk, there are some risk factors over which we have no control. Genetics is one of them. If you have a first blood relative who's had Alzheimer's disease, you are at a greater risk than the general population of developing the disease. You may not, but you're at a greater risk. Those are things we have no control over. The things we have control over are our cardiovascular health. Anything that's good for your heart is good for your brain. What does that mean? It means aerobic exercise, so that your veins and arteries are pumping your blood and your brain is getting the oxygen that it needs in the most effective way and efficient way possible. So aerobic exercise, getting your heart rate up, not smoking, eating right. Those are the kinds of things that we want to be doing. Staying engaged and connected. Challenging yourself to learn new things. And this goes for people who have the disease. I'm not saying it's going to reverse it. That doesn't exist, right? But if we stay connected, the more social opportunities we have, the more pathways of information we create in our brains, the more new things we try and learn. If you can play three musical instruments, I don't mean go learn a fourth. I mean do something that requires your attention. Go learn how to swim or ski or something totally outside of your comfort zone, something you really have to focus on. When we're really focused on something outside of our comfort zones, we're creating dendrites, pathways for information in our brains, new ways for those neurons to communicate, which has real value in our ability to process information in a meaningful way. So if you're looking to manage risk, those are the things that are rooted in science. Those are the things that have efficacy and are empirically justified and proven. The rest of it, we just don't know. They're exciting. They deserve more attention and more study, but we don't have answers to that. We can't say yet what the impact of the chocolate and the blueberries and the red wine and the coffee. Other questions? Yes. Absolutely. That's a great question. So, and this is when sort of make the brain a better offer can be helpful. So what are the kinds of things that your father has historically enjoyed?
Intellectual things like reading the New York Times and playing chess, which obviously he can't do.
Yeah. So
that's kind of hard.
What about music? No music. Yeah.
In either fear or anxiety or wanting everybody to everything has to leave the house and pack up, and it's just that anxiety, you just can't get through, you've tried everything, sometimes you can't get that.
Yeah. So I think the first thing that I would suggest is getting his attention. To know that you have some sort of connection, right? And where that can be by having that eye contact, like knowing Dad. Like get his attention. And then in the calmest, soothest way that I can, say, we're fine. Everything's okay. You're okay. We are all okay. We're safe. Right? Because what's happening is that anxiety, that fear. So how do we address what's underlying? It's not about the reality in which he's living. It's what's underneath it. And if we can figure out a way to get that attention and then validate the emotions through empathizing and letting him know that everything's okay. We're exactly where you are. I'm going to take good care of you. I'm fine. Just that reassurance. Once you have the attention. So if he's, you know, sort of panicking and all over and you know, trying to gather things and where's this and looking for something, and that's why that attention piece is really key. So you not shake him into reality, but you snap him into getting his attention, and then very calmly, quietly, using your voice, you hear the way that my voice just changed, and we are fine. And I'm not breaking eye contact with you. And I'm soothing with my facial expressions, with my body language. I might grab his hand, touch his hand. I might not, depending on how upset he is. I might put my hand on his shoulder or his arm or not. I'm going to try and get him to sit down. If he's in a room, if he's, you know, in the bedroom and that's happening, I would do whatever I needed to do to change his physical environment. I would get him out of that room. I would say, let's go sit down. We got to breathe for a minute. Let's just take a minute. Or if, you know, and even stepping into his world, I'm going to help you find everything we need. Come on. And change that environment. And sometimes getting him into a different room can be really helpful. Sometimes if you get his attention and he's willing to go along with you, I might look and see if having a coffee or a tea or a cold glass of water, or if it's nice enough out and it's okay, let's get out. You know what, Dad? Come with me. I'm gonna make sure that we're fine, it's safe, right? What are those awful memories about? Everything but fine. And safe and okay and taken care of. So if we can figure out a way to convey a sense of that safety and well-being and calmness and change that environment, so it's relate, distract, redirect, and make the brain a better offer. If it's music, if there is music, and sometimes it's not. Sometimes music is a trigger, and that's why you need to know the person, right? But the reason why I jumped to music is, remember at the beginning I mentioned the brain is compartmentalized. Music transcends that compartmentalization. So have you ever heard a song and it puts you back into a different time? Like you're just all of a sudden transported to another time or place. You know what you were wearing. You can smell it. You know who is there. You're just transported. Music has an opportunity to get in ways that other things don't, because it touches all those it's processed in all those different parts of the brain. It's really multisensory. So other multisensory stimulation can be really calming and soothing as well. Whether it's, you know, the perfume that a person used to wear, or a cologne, or a different kind of smell, or, you know, reading from the Torah, or praying, those kinds of, anything that has historically brought this person calm, a sense of calm, in other periods of stress and strain, can be really useful and helpful. Is that, yeah? I want to go in the back because you've been patient too, I appreciate it. So we're dealing with people who we care about and care for, and it's complicated and difficult. Where do we go to learn coping strategies that can help sustain us and our ability to do it? So I couldn't, you couldn't have asked a better question if I had paid you to do it. Our organization, I think, is a really perfect place to go. And the services that Zicharon provides as well. The key really is getting that support. So understanding that you're not alone and hearing from people that they're going through something similar is tremendously helpful in your understanding that there are ways to engage in ways that allow you to sort of honor all the emotional roller coaster that you're on as well. So we offer support groups that can be particularly helpful. We also offer a family caregiver workshop, which is a 10-hour training that can help you learn strategies to cope. So we talk about the basics of the disease, some of what I touched on tonight. We talk about strategies to enhance communication in a setting that allows you to talk about what's going on in your situation so that you can process the emotional impact that it's having on you while also learning skills and strategies to address the issue. Managing challenging behaviors. So what I touched on tonight in the very short time we've had together is not even really barely scratching at the surface. There's so much more that we can unpack and really dive into in our trainings and our sessions, and we're actually working with Zicharon to bring more of these programs and in different ways out to the Orthodox community so that we can better meet your needs and work with you to find the support. We also have social workers who are really experts in this. Our social work, not everything we do is focusing on the person with the disease. A lot of what our social workers do is provide you with the emotional support to reconcile the complicated feelings that you have. We provide individual and family counseling that address exactly what it is that you ask. How do I reconcile all these complicated feelings that I have in a way that allows me to continue to be the best caregiver that I can be? And all of the programs and services that we provide are free of charge. We have a 24-hour helpline you can call. Sometimes people aren't comfortable sharing personal information. You want to remain anonymous. We don't care. That's fine. You can make up a name. You can say, I'd rather not tell you. That's not why we're here. We don't care. If you give us your information, we can put you on our mailing list and send you information and stay in touch with you. But if you don't want to, that's fine. We want to start where you are. We don't drag you into our world. We step into yours, right? So we want to help you in any way that you're comfortable. If that's remaining anonymous and just calling and getting some information on the phone, and you know, please know that we can help. We have a tremendous array of resources, even things that are specific to the Orthodox community that we can provide you with, even if we're not necessarily members of the Orthodox community. We've done in-services for our staff. We've done research. Leia has come and talked with our staff. Harriet has come and talked with our staff from OHELSH just upstairs. So we do the best that we can to understand the unique aspects of your cultural and religious experiences that may make these situations challenging and even more challenging, perhaps. So we have tools in our toolboxes that we can share with you that I hope you'll call and take advantage of. Again, we have our programs and services brochures upstairs. Yes. You warm my heart. The last part that she just said is, I want to know what to expect. I want information so that I understand what's coming. That is a real, that's not always the state in which people come to us. It's the state in which we try to get people. I think, you know, I talk to my staff and I say, people often say, I don't want to know. I can only deal with what's right in front of me. That's enough. And I say it's our job to pull that curtain back a little bit. Because if you... Right. So let us educate you.
Right.
Yes, let us help you. We can help you whatever stage your mother-in-law is in. And some of that, you know, I'm talking very generally because I don't have the opportunity to know exactly the situations each of you finds yourselves. So I'm speaking generally, but we have information, education, support, and resources for every stage of the disease. And as I said, it can be hard to pin someone down to one stage. So based on what you're saying, I wouldn't even begin to say where I thought your mother-in-law is in the spectrum of the illness. It's more complicated than that. But our social workers will say, well, tell us about how she spends her days. Tell us about what she can do, what she can't do, all of that, to give us an idea of what her strengths and abilities are. And then we help you come at it from that perspective. And then we pull the curtain back and let you know what's coming. Because without being prepared for what's coming, we're certainly not up to meet the demands of the needs of the individual. So, two incredibly wonderful opportunities for me to talk about the work that we do and to hopefully plant those seeds to get you to, again, be willing to come to us and allow us to support you in these journeys. I want to, you know, I don't have any more time, and I know there's someone speaking after me, but I want to end with something that I said already, which is, you cannot do it alone. And if there's one thing that I hope you leave tonight, it's understanding that you don't have to. Because there are great organizations like Zicharon and like Caring Kind that are here to support you. And again, if you feel alone and you feel like you're the only one going through this, look around the room. The numbers of people affected by this disease are growing every day. In lieu of disease-modifying treatment, in lieu of medical options, the best way that we can prepare for what's ahead of us is to learn how to provide the highest quality of care. And those are the things that we're able to teach you how to do. And we don't just give you information and then, you know, send you on your way. When you reach out to us, you connect to a resource of people who give you the information you need when you need it. We are on that journey with you for the long haul. You call us as often or as infrequently as you want or need. And we're going to be there with you every step of the way throughout the journey that you're on. So I want, in closing, you know, to thank you so much for taking time to spend with me this evening. I hope that you found it helpful. I hope you will pick up the programs and services brochures upstairs. And I really hope that you'll take advantage of everything that we have to offer. So thank you again so much.